Three Cups of Tea, Excerpt 1, by Greg Mortensen and David Oliver Rellin. From his base in Haji Ali's home, Mortensen settled into a routine. Each morning and afternoon, he would walk briefly about Korf, accompanied, as always, by children tugging at his hands. He saw how his tiny oasis of greenery in a desert of dusty rock owed its existence to staggering labor and admired the hundreds of irrigation channels the village maintained by hand that diverted glacial meltwater toward their fields and orchards. Off the Baltero, out of danger, he realized just how precarious his own survival had been and how weakened he'd become. He could barely make it down the switchback path that led to the river, and there, in the freezing water, when he took off his shirt to wash, he was shocked by his appearance. "My arms look like spindly little toothpicks, like they belonged to somebody else," Mortensen says. Wheezing his way back up to the village, he felt as infirm as the elderly men who sat for hours at a time under Korf's apricot trees, smoking from hookahs and eating apricot kernels. After an hour or two of poking about each day, he'd succumb to exhaustion and return to stare at the sky from his nest of pillows by Haji Ali's hearth. The Nirmadar watched Mortensen's state carefully and ordered one of the village's precious Chogo Rabbik, or big rams, slaughtered. 40 people tore every scrap of roasted meat from the skinny animal's bones, then cracked open the bones themselves with rocks, stripping the marrow with their teeth. Watching the ardor with which the meat was devoured, Mortensen realized how rare such a meal was for the people of Korf and how close they lived to hunger. At first, in Korf, he thought he'd stumbled into a sort of Shangri-La. Many Westerners passing through the place had the feeling that the Balti lived a simpler, better life than they did back home in their developed countries. Early visitors, casting about for suitably romantic names, dubbed it Tibet of the Apricots. The Balti really seemed to have a flair for enjoying life, Moraney wrote in 1958, after visiting a school and admiring the old bodies of men sitting in the sun, smoking their picturesque pipes, those not so old working at primitive looms in the shade of the mulberry trees, with that sureness of touch that comes with a lifetime's experience. And two boys, sitting by themselves, removing their lice with tender and meticulous care. "We breathed an air of utter satisfaction, of eternal peace," he continued. "All this gives rise to a question. Isn't it better to live in ignorance of everything? Asphalt and macadam, vehicles, telephones, television. To live in bliss without knowing it?" 35 years later, the Balti still lived with the same lack of modern conveniences. But after even a few days in the village, Mortensen began to see that Korf was far from the pre-lapsarian paradise of Western fantasy. In every home, at least one family member suffered from goiters or cataracts. The children, whose ginger hair he had admired, owed their coloring to a form of malnutrition called kwashiorkor. And he learned from his talks with Tuaha, after the Nirmadar's son returned from evening prayer at the village mosque, that the nearest doctor was a week's walk from Skardu, and one out of every three Korf children died before reaching their first birthday. Often during his time in Korf, Mortensen felt the presence of his little sister Krista, especially when he was with Korf's children. "Everything about their life was a struggle," Mortensen says. "They reminded me of the way Krista had to fight for the simplest things, and also the way she had of just persevering, no matter what life threw at her." He decided he wanted to do something for them. Perhaps, when he got to Islamabad, he'd use the last of his money to buy textbooks to send to their school, or supplies. Lying by the hearth before bed, Mortensen told Haji Ali he wanted to visit Korf's school. Mortensen saw a cloud pass across the old man's craggy face, but persisted. Finally, the headman agreed to take Mortensen first thing the following morning. After their familiar breakfast of chapatis and cha, Haji Ali led Mortensen up a steep path to a vast open ledge, 800 feet above the Braldu. The view was exquisite, with the ice giants of the upper Baltoro razored into the blue far above Corpse's gray rock walls. But Mortensen wasn't admiring the scenery. He was appalled to see 82 children, 78 boys, and the four girls who had the pluck to join them, kneeling on the frosty ground in the open. Haji Ali, avoiding Mortensen's eyes, said that the village had no school, and the Pakistani government didn't provide a teacher. A teacher cost the equivalent of $1 a day, he explained, which was more than the village could afford. So, they shared a teacher with the neighboring village of Munjung, and he taught in Korp 3 days a week. The rest of the time, the children were left alone to practice the lessons he left behind. Mortensen watched, his heart in his throat, as the students stood at rigid attention and began their school day with Pakistan's national anthem. Blessed be the sacred land, happy be the bounteous realm, symbol of high resolve, land of Pakistan. They sang with sweet raggedness, their breath steaming in air already touched with winter. Mortensen picked out Twaha's 7-year-old daughter, Jahan, standing tall and straight beneath her headscarf as she sang, May the nation, the country, and the state shine in glory everlasting. This flag of crescent and star leads the way to progress and perfection. After the last note of the anthem had faded, the children sat in a neat circle and began copying their multiplication tables. Most scratched in the dirt with sticks they'd brought for that purpose. The more fortunate, like Jahan, had slate boards they wrote on with sticks dipped in a mixture of mud and water. Can you imagine a fourth grade class in America, alone, without a teacher, sitting there quietly and working on their lessons? Mortensen asks. I felt like my heart was being torn out. There was a fierceness in their desire to learn, despite how mightily everything was stacked against them, that reminded me of Krista. I knew I had to do something. But what? He had just enough money, if he ate simply and stayed in the cheapest guest houses, to travel by jeep and bus back to Islamabad and catch his flight home. In California, he could look forward to only sporadic nursing work, and most of his possessions fit in the trunk of La Bamba, the burgundy gas-guzzling Buick that was as close as he had to a home. Still, there had to be something. Standing next to Haji Ali, on the ledge overlooking the valley, with such a crystalline view of the mountains he'd come halfway around the world to measure himself against, climbing K2 to place a necklace on its summit, suddenly felt beside the point. There was a much more meaningful gesture he could make in honor of his sister's memory. He put his hands on Haji Ali's shoulders, as the old man had done to him dozens of times since they'd shared their first cup of tea. I'm going to build you a school, he said, not yet realizing that with those words, the path of his life had just detoured down another trail, a route far more serpentine and arduous than the wrong turns he'd taken since retreating from K2. I will build a school, Mortensen said. I promise.